Blog Talk Radio.
Well, why won't we go to the doctor? My uncle called. Speech all slurred, complaining his arm's numb. He called everyone. He even called my daughter Tierra, because, you know, she's got a year of nursing. Everyone thinks he needs to go to the doctor, including me. So he said, well, will you take me? I'm like, I'm on the road. He goes, I'll wait. Stroke's no joke. Dial 911. Time loss is brain loss. Seriously, dial 911.
Visit StrokesNoJoke.org, brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes, and I want to thank you again for listening to the show this morning. Earlier, we spoke with Mark McEwen, former CBS anchor, and his experience of having a stroke. So please check out the archive of that show that was earlier this morning. But right now, we're going to be speaking with author Rebecca Walker. Time magazine named Rebecca Walker one of the 50 most influential American leaders under 40 because of her transformative views on race, gender, sexuality, and power. She was also including the Woman Who Could Be President Award from the League of Women Voters, and she has an honorary doctorate from the North Carolina School for the Arts. I'm going to reach out to Rebecca right now and give her a call. I hope you guys can check out some of the other wonderful shows that I've done. Check out Nikki Giovanni. You can click on her picture on the webpage. Also, jazz bassist Christian McBride. You can check out, that was a great, funny, really, he's a funny guy. Check out that. And also, I did an interview with Angie Stone about diabetes and her battle with diabetes. So you can check all those out on my page. What I want to say this morning is that this is May is a Stroke Awareness Month, and it's so important that people pay attention to their body and the symptoms they may be having. One of the acronyms we talked about earlier on the show is FAST, F-A-S-T, numbness in the face, numbness in the arms, and problems with your speech, and then also time. Time is of the essence. So it's very important to pay attention to those symptoms. I'm going to try now to...
All right, there we go, there we go.
Hello.
Good morning, Ms. Walker. Okay, now we can hear, everybody can hear. Wow,
okay.
That's just sometimes technology, you know, it's a new medium, the social medium, podcasting, and sometimes it's friendly and sometimes it acts up a little bit. But thank you so much again for calling in. Again, for those of you who are listening, I'm very sorry for the technical difficulties we were having this morning, the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. This is author Rebecca Walker. We're going to be talking this morning about her book, One Big Happy Family, explores the explosion of non-traditional family configurations in the U.S. and includes perspectives on polyamory, transracial adoption, house husbandry, and single motherhood. Rebecca Walker is the author of also the third wave primer, To Be Real, Telling the Truth and Changing the Face of Feminism. She also has a memoir, Black, White, and Jewish, Autobiography of Shifting Self. Good morning, Ms. Walker.
Good morning. How are you?
I am good. I'm glad that you were able to make it. I know you were very busy. She was overseas doing her thing, and so I'm so happy to have you on this morning. The book is very interesting. It really breaks all the preconceptions you have of what a typical family. You know, we think of family as a man, a woman, maybe the man is the provider going out, working hard, the woman's at home, taking care of the kids, and then we have, you know, the second phase of maybe now both parents are working, trying to take care of the kids, but unfortunately women are still taking a lot of the burden. Your book breaks all of that. Why did you think it was important to write a book about families?
Well, I think the American family is changing so much, and they're not getting as much, these new families aren't getting as much support from the press and from the culture at large as they need. So I wanted to do something that would support the decisions they're making and also kind of normalize this new configuration. So everything from one of my favorite pieces in the book is by Asha Bandele, who wrote The Prisoner's Wife, about, you know, her relationship with her husband who is incarcerated. With 2 million people incarcerated, that's a lot of families who have members who are incarcerated.
Yeah.
So that's a new kind of family that's not really validated in the culture.
You also talk about polyamory. Talk about that. Tell the audience, for those of you who don't know, what
polyamory. Polyamory is not to be confused with swingers who are having random sex with random people, or to be confused with polygamy, which is what you see on Big Love on television. But polyamory is really when people decide to have long-term committed relationships with more than one person. So it comes in all configurations. The piece in One Big Happy Family is about a woman who was happily married for many years and then decided she wanted to have another person in their relationship, and the process she went through with her husband of bringing this person into the relationship. And now I think the three of them and their daughter have been together for several years. So
yes.
So it's a, you know, people are doing it in all different ways now. You know, one of my favorite pieces too is about a guy who gave his sperm to one of his closest friends, and when I was asking him to write the piece, because they of course now have a completely different family. He's not in touch with his biological child, but his mother is very connected to her grandchild with this other woman. I mean, it's all very complex. But I said, so why did you do this? And he said, well, I did it because I could. He did it because he knew he could make a difference in this woman's life, and he wanted to give her that gift. And so that's another kind of family.
Yeah.
And
let me read some something from your book, talking about the one of the chapters with the woman who made the decision to go outside her marriage and find another partner and bring the woman in. She said, why I married then? Many people have asked me that question. So I'll tell you exactly what I tell them. As hot as it makes me when a new conquest whispers something scandalous in my ear, nothing thrills me like the sound of Christopher's voice when I hear him say, hey, baby, I'm home. And for the listeners, Christopher was the woman's husband. And it really shattered my view, because I grew up though, my family was I had my mom and I had a stepfather. Mm-hmm. And even though my stepfather, I will give him shout outs, he really tried to take care of me. When I would have any disagreement, I would bring up the fact that he wasn't my real father.
Mm-hmm.
But mind you, I didn't know my real father until I was about 18, 19 years old.
Yes.
You know,
totally.
So, you talk about that also, step families.
Definitely, and that, you know, I think step families and blended families are the kinds of new families that most Americans are most familiar with, because so many of us are children of divorce. You know, divorce became much more accessible and legal in the 60s, and so a lot of us are children of, we're kind of like divorce babies,
mm-hmm,
in some
mm-hmm.
ways, and so we know a lot about, you know, parents divorcing, remarrying, bringing kids together, step-parenting, and that was very challenging for a lot of us. I think that's one of the reasons that I did the book is, you know, I had that experience and struggled with it, really, in a lot of ways, as it sounds like you did, and wanted to do a book that offered, you know, pictures of families that did it successfully and were, you know, making it work.
Well, one of the things you, when I think about family, I always think about children, but you bring about issues of other types of families. For example, in the book, you talk about the woman who helped her friend, her gay friend, who was from a Muslim country. She married him because she loved him. And they lived together. And that's kind of like, you know, you say, what? Okay, she married him, she loved him, but I think it really expounds the boundaries of what love is in your book.
Yes, yes. That's a great piece. She loves him, and, you know, she doesn't want him to have to go to back home where she knows he's going to be brutalized, and the way to help him stay is to marry him, and it's not just a green card marriage. It's a, you know, they've been close friends for many years, and there's a profound deep connection and love between them. So she really, when they marry, she feels completely married, and they work it out, you know. I think that it's time, you know, in the English language, we are limited by, you know, one or two words to describe love, and in other languages like, you know, Hindi or, you know, other languages in the world, they have,
mm-hmm.
you know, many, many different words to describe love. There are so many different kinds of love, and there's so many nuances and shades of love, and people around the world understand that. But in English, it tends to be very simplistic in a way,
because
we just have this one word. But so yes, I think the book is an attempt to really open that up and show that the human heart beats strongly and
in a variety of ways.
Yes, and is in need of our support. You know, that if we really care, then we will really understand that it looks different than it ever has, and that those people need us to validate them.
Right, and talking about this relationship between the man's name is Rozzy, the woman says marrying Rozzy, I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, wasn't a silly prank that went too far. It was love, and it didn't matter that it was non-sexual. It was real. I thought Rozzy was the one who needed me, but the reality was that he filled an empty space in my life as only a child of divorced parents. We needed each other. We had become a family. We always would be. So it filled this void where she thought she was helping him, but in turn he helped her grow as a person. And talking about growing as a parent, and you're a parent also, when you have a child who has a disability, one of your stories talks about a woman who's in a foreign country. She's in Japan dealing with her child who has a disability, cerebral palsy, I believe it is, and her whole relationship with the mother-in-law. And I know there's always jokes and comedy, there's always jokes about the mother-in-law, this and that, but really in Japanese culture, she was married to the eldest son, you explain, and he basically felt his duty to take care of the mother-in-law, but they had very different views about raising children. That's something that women struggle with, being the number one woman in the man's life, competing with the mom, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and she had that bad. I mean, she really had to struggle, and you know, initially it's difficult enough that, you know, as the oldest son, her husband is expected to live and take care of his mother, you know, constantly as the primary
mm-hmm.
woman in his life. And then once she has her children, whom she's wanted desperately, and one of them is disabled and does have cerebral palsy, the mother, the grandmother, feels nothing but shame, because in the Japanese culture, if you have that kind of, any real kind of disability, it's a shame, it's a curse on the family, the child should not be seen, they'd be better off dead. I mean, these are some of the things that the mother-in-law said to her, and it was very difficult for her as an American woman with completely different views to maintain this relationship, living in Japan with her husband, with her disabled child, and her mother-in-law, who completely disapproved of everything, including her daughter. You know, I mean, it was like, oh my God.
She didn't want to take her outside. She didn't want to, she was upset about taking her outside. Actually, in the book you wrote, the first day of our cohabitation, a Saturday, she being the mother-in-law, pops in every half an hour. So you're in the house, you're the mom, and every half an hour the mother-in-law's popping in. She's concerned when she finds that I have not yet prepared lunch, though it is noon. Never mind that she saw us eating a late breakfast. So this is just a constant relenting struggle she had. That was a very difficult. I really felt bad for the woman in that situation. But then they did finally come to a balance, and I think that's important in families, no matter what configuration you have, is the balance of the individual's needs over the group needs.
Exactly.
And
I think that's really what the book is about, is trying to find that. And those of you who've read Baby Love and know that I have struggled to find that within my own family understand a lot of, you know, about why I did this book, because it's something that's very important to me, trying to figure out that balance.
Now, one of the interesting couples was a nomadic couple. And they had a baby underwater, and they were living in different places, and they were going. So it talks also about untraditional ways of having a baby. You mentioned earlier about the man who donated his sperm to his friend. That's a form of love. I thought that was very beautiful. I did worry when I read about the son. I wonder, because on TV, the radio, everywhere, you have these relenting and constant, almost like you're being hypnotized about what a family is. So I wondered about what the little boy would do when he got older, and he had a dad, but he didn't have a dad. Are you still in touch with that family? How has that worked out?
Yeah, well, apparently, I just talked to the dad a few weeks ago, and apparently he's in his life. The child knows he's his father, but he doesn't really, you know, he's not around daily. He has two parents, his two moms, and so you know, he doesn't have any paternal kind of directives in the child's life. So he doesn't decide what school he goes to or what he eats or
right.
what, you know, he's an ongoing presence. And so it's not as if his son is going to wake up and say, "Where's my dad?" He will know his dad his whole life. But the relationship is different. You know, it's not the way we think, you know, a father, you know, normally is involved.
Yeah, I'm sure you got some backlash. This book really, again, breaking the barriers and expanding, I think, our concept of love from conservatives. I mean,
yeah.
The whole issue of you know, two women having a baby without a male presence there, the issue of the woman having a relationship with a man in prison, and that was really hard. I'm a single parent, and so I really connected to that story after she did have the second baby and went full term with it, and that decision to break that relationship, I really felt pain in my heart for her, because it is difficult being a single parent and not having a large support system.
Oh, my God. That is one of the most painful. I mean, and Asha Bandela is one of my favorite writers, and if any of the listeners know her work, she documented her falling in love with her husband, Rashid, while she was teaching writing in the prison, and then getting married in prison, and her becoming pregnant in prison, and then her keeping, you know, and so the book, her first book ends kind of with that. And then this new book that she's done, and this piece came out before that book, is really about what happened next, which is that she couldn't bear bringing her child into the prison system every month or every week or every, you know, that it was just
Yeah,
too
the strain
much.
Was just too, yeah,
oh,
too much. You
terrible.
Know? Yes, yes.
And being a single mother at the same time, you know, in our culture is so challenging. I mean,
and being an African-American woman as a single mother, you feel like, oh, my God, I'm just a stereotypical case. Here we go. I'm walking down the street. Oh, you know, and you don't have a ring on your finger. It's like, ah, you know, you go through these things. But I will say it can be done. And I say stay the course and you know, try to reach out to other moms, whether they're married or single, to get advice. But in breaking what women should do, one of your couples, they had a very equal relationship. They, the husband really pushed back against the woman to say, "I want to be more involved." And and in your book, their struggle of the woman releasing her control over the situation. Talk about that. That's very difficult sometimes for women to think they know the best about taking care of a kid when maybe they don't.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting. Well, they're all so interesting, especially now that you talk about all of them. I'm really enjoying hearing about it. But yeah,
it's a wonderful book, Rebecca. It's a wonderful book. One Big Happy Family. If you're listening, please check out her book. And also, she has a website, RebeccaWalker.com. So please check that out. But go ahead.
Also, we're doing this great series on the Huffington Post. I have a blog on the Huffington Post, and we're having people write all about their different family configurations. So every week, there's a new short piece about how people are living. So check that out, too.
Definitely.
But, yeah, that piece, that's a great piece because it's about how a man really tries to be a part of raising this newborn baby and being, you know, an equal partner, and they've committed to being equal partners. And mom has a really hard time letting go and letting her husband actually be a part at the most intimate level of raising this child, and she's got this almost primal,
instinctual,
don't touch my
child.
Yeah. And I really understand that, you know, but at the same time, if we want men to be more participatory and we want them to share in this experience and help us with this burden, you know, that we often feel, just the overwhelm of it, we have to learn how to let them and to believe that they are competent and that they know what they're doing and, you know, that if they have issues or questions, they'll ask, and that they have every right to be as much a part of the child's, you know, development at that early stage as we do. So that's
a
huge shift.
Yeah, the communication, that's another. So we talked about the expanding of love and the different configurations and single parenthood, but the communication throughout all of the stories is key. And that's what brings the love about, is communicating your worries and your concerns and your dislikes, but in a respectful way, you know, not to put the other person down. That seemed to make all the families stronger when they got a lot of stuff on the table. you know, about...
I really agree with that. But that's one of the things that I learned is, you know, communication is key, and making decisions together as much as you can is part of how you keep the fiber of your family together, no matter what the configuration. If you resist sort of this idea of breaking off on your own and just doing whatever it is that you want, but really sitting down and trying to find out what's best for everyone in the family. And you may not, as the famous song goes, you may not get everything you want, but hopefully, you know, as a family, you'll get what you need. And in the long term, you know, I think we need families more than ever as the world undergoes these incredible upheavals. So I really wanted to do the book not just to support these families, but to help all families to figure out ways to stay together, because we need each other.
Yes. Well, we only have a minute left, and I just want to thank you so much again for waking up this morning. I know it was very difficult. I'm sorry. I apologize for the technical difficulties. Some things happen out of our control, just like in families, things happen out of our control. But hopefully, please stay in touch, and we can have you back on for any new ventures that you're doing. Please check out RebeccaWalker.com. Also, check her out on Huffington Post. Like she mentioned, she's doing a weekly series about families and people sharing their stories. Thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. Thank you.
It's so much my pleasure, Joy, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Take very good care, and bye, everyone.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. You're welcome. Bye.
Thank you to all the listeners this morning. I really apologize for technical difficulties. Remember, you can follow me on twitter.com/joykeys. You can also become a fan of the show on Facebook. Please check that out. And remember, May is Stroke Awareness Month, so please pay attention to the signs that are happening in your life. Have a wonderful Saturday, and stay tuned next Saturday.
This is Chicago-style hot dog here. I'm not feeling too good. Turns out, along with all the other bad things my cholesterol does, they say it's a risk factor for strokes. Strokes? Sheesh. Good news from National Stroke Association. Exercising, eating right, and asking your doctor about medicines that can help lower your cholesterol, like statins, may reduce the risk of a first stroke. And if you've already had a stroke, it's even more important you lower your cholesterol.
Lower your chances of stroke by controlling your cholesterol. Visit stroke.org today.